It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about how a unique collaboration is at work to transform Milwaukee's Carver Academy, a struggling public school.
First, we're focusing on Governor Scott Walker's performance in the GOP debate last night. It was a crowded stage with 10 potential candidates trying to separate themselves from the pack.
Governor Walker was vying for the limelight alongside candidates like Donald Trump and Jeb Bush.
We're joined now by Craig Gilbert, the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who covered the debate last night. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Nice to be with you.
Well, Craig, what did you think about Governor Walker's performance in the debate last night?
Well, in a word, I would say it was okay. It was not, I don't think you find anybody, at least on the media side, on the political side, who would say that Governor Walker won the debate out of all the candidates that were on stage. Some people were critical of his performance. Some people thought he did decently. They went into the debate with a strategy that was kind of guaranteed to place him a little bit on the sidelines. I mean, he was not going to call attention to himself by engaging and skirmishing with the other Republicans on stage. You weren't going to hear a lot of histrionics. He was trying, I think, to kind of strike a firm but congenial demeanor. And that's his kind of personal style, and that's something that they're trying to project in the course of this campaign. He made it very clear he wasn't going to skirmish with the other candidates, but with Donald Trump the center of attention and some of the lower-tier candidates striving for attention, it meant that Governor Walker faded into the background at times.
Right, and he was, I think, in terms of total talking time in the debate, he was second to the bottom of that list. Now, on the one hand, as you said, faded into the background. On the other hand, there was nothing out there maybe that would alienate voters with some sort of more scrappy behavior. What did you think about that as a strategy overall? Is it safe since it's so early?
It was a safe strategy. It was a low-risk strategy. It wasn't a no-risk strategy because, you could say that there was maybe a bit of a lost opportunity here. I mean, we've seen the numbers on the volume of people that watched this debate. It had a massive audience. Governor Walker is doing pretty well in the polling compared to other candidates in the race, but there's still about, half of the Republican voters out there that don't really know him, that he's trying to introduce himself to. So this is a great opportunity to do that, and I don't think he damaged himself, but I think he might have not exploited the debate to the degree that he could have by being a more forceful presence. I mean, part of the problem was early in the debate, particularly, his answers were so short that he wasn't using all of his allotted time, and that was one reason why there was only one other Republican on stage who had less speaking time than Governor Walker did. But in the end, I think his team was, more or less satisfied with his performance, partly because he didn't really make any big mistakes, and partly because he didn't have the same urgency to make a splash given his relatively strong position in the race as some of the other Republicans on stage.
Maybe his biggest cheers came when he seemed to quip about Hillary Clinton's emails. We got some audio of that bit of the debate last night, courtesy of Fox News.
Well, first off, per the cyber attack with Russia the other day, it's sad to think right now, but probably the Russian and Chinese government know more about Hillary Clinton's email server than do the members of the United States Congress.
Was that a high point for Governor Walker last night?
Yeah, it was probably his pithiest line. I think going into a debate, you try to have some lines like that in your back pocket, and that one kind of connected with the audience. So I think that was kind of a high moment for him. It's a little bit of a tricky issue for Governor Walker in the sense that when he was county executive, he used private emails to communicate. And in fact, I asked him about that today at a post-debate stop at a deli in Cleveland, and he was very insistent that there was no inconsistency in criticizing Hillary Clinton about emails when he used private emails, arguing that because her emails involved classified information and his did not, that it was perfectly appropriate for him to make that criticism.
We're talking to Craig Gilbert right now, the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at Governor Walker's performance in the Republican debate last night. And The moderators asked him last night about his job creation record. This is something that's obviously been tracked closely here in Wisconsin, too, that 250,000 job pledge. How did you think he handled that, about not hitting that benchmark that he'd promised?
Yeah, I mean, one of the challenges for him in this debate, obviously the candidates can't control the questions they're asked. I thought that it took Governor Walker a long time in this debate to get to the meat of his message about his history in Wisconsin and battling and fighting and winning, the whole recall story that's so appealing to Republican primary voters outside Wisconsin. And one of the reasons was he was getting some tough questions from the panelists about his position on abortion, about his shift on immigration, and also about his jobs record, as you point out. He's had a lot of practice answering this question, so I think he was pretty relaxed in the way he handled that question. I think he did a good job with it. I mean, his argument was that, you know, when you aim high, sometimes you don't meet your goals, but the voters wanted somebody to aim high, and his ultimate argument is that he got reelected, even though jobs was an issue that was on the table in this election. You know, he won those elections despite not meeting his jobs pledge. I think that the jobs issue is a little bit of a vulnerability for him, but it might be more of a vulnerability in a general election setting than in a primary, because I think it's hard for other Republicans to criticize his record as governor, because he was a very conservative governor. When you're criticizing his record in a Republican contest, you're sort of criticizing his conservative policy agenda, too.
He got a little bit into his vision for the United States should he be elected president. He got a little bit into the economics of it. Here's a little bit from the debate last night, again from Fox News.
I think most of us in America understand that people, not the government, creates jobs. And one of the best things we can do is get the government out of the way, repeal Obamacare, put in rein in all the out-of-control regulations, put in place an all-the-above energy policy, get people the education and skills that they need to succeed, and lower the tax rate and reform the tax code. That's what I'll do as president, just like I did in Wisconsin.
And so once the governor got to that big picture stuff, the vision stuff, do you think that he delivered on his vision and sold it to the crowd?
Well, that answer felt a little bit rushed to me. I mean, that came at a point in time when he hadn't had a lot of speaking time in the debate, again, for the reasons we discussed. And it felt to me like he was trying to cram an awful lot into one answer. It really wasn't until his closing statement where he talked about the recall, which is a story he loves to tell over and over again in this contest, that I think he really struck a strong note with Republican viewers and Republican voters, where he talked about Democrats coming after him and winning and winning again and winning again. And I think it was surprising to me that it took all that time in the debate for him to get to that part of his message.
Now, you used the word safe to describe sort of what happened with Governor Walker last night. He wasn't in there. He wasn't, for the most part, trying to mix it up with the other candidates and score hit points. He was hanging back a little bit, sticking to his message. But do you think at a certain point that strategy will have to end if the other candidates start knocking each other out? Does he have to start taking more swings at a certain point?
Well, I think we can expect the race overall to get, I mean, as raucous as this debate was, you know, there are going to be more confrontations, more clashes. The governor has spent a lot of time talking about how Republicans shouldn't beat up on each other, but he's perfectly content to draw contrast and even offer implicit criticisms, not explicit criticisms and not personal attacks, but implied criticisms of other candidates in the race. When he talks about being a fighter and a winner, he's basically saying that all the other candidates in the race are either fighters who haven't won anything or they're winners who haven't fought for anything. When he talks about being a fresh face, he's talking about the other candidates in the race who are not fresh faces. When he talks about how he's not from Washington, he's looking at some of the other candidates in the race who are in the Senate or former senators who are Washington, creatures of Washington in his eyes. So he's going to draw those contrasts, but he wants to do it in a way that sort of strikes a less confrontational tone. And I think as he, I mean, it was interesting in the debate that he didn't come under attack. I think coming under attack for him is, in a sense, an opportunity to tell his story and talk about his record, but it also does pose some risks, and I think he's going to have to decide in the next debate if he comes under fire, you know, how forcefully he wants to be in responding to that.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
That was Craig Gilbert, the Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, with a look at Governor Walker's performance in the Republican debate last night.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
We check in on an effort to transform one struggling school in Milwaukee. In the past, the Carver Academy of Math and Science in the Brewers Hill neighborhood has had a rough time with high suspension rates, low attendance, and the achievement gap. But a collaboration between five groups is working to turn the public school around by changing the culture and working hard to get kids excited about learning.
Jabril Farage joins us now to talk about the changes at Carver Academy. He's a journalist who wrote about the school for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. Jabril, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, what kinds of things has the Carver Academy struggled with in the past?
Well, like you guys mentioned, they've had very high suspension rates, low attendance, and you know, it's been tough there academically for the students.
Now, at one point, it sounds like there was talk of turning the school over to expand it into a successful Montessori program instead. What happened at that point?
Well, MPS board member Terry Falk actually wrote a piece for Milwaukee Magazine in 2011, I believe, titled Why Carver Academy Matters. And it talks about a lot of those issues, and it was actually linked to through my piece. But yeah, there was a lot of back and forth. It was going to be closed at one point, then it was going to become a charter school, and then it was decided that it would be reopened or would stay as a traditional MPS school.
Now, ultimately, a new collaboration came together to try and turn Carver around. Tell us about which groups came together to unite their energies and how that whole synergy happened.
Yeah, it's MPS, obviously, the Northwestern Mutual Foundation, which is funding this collaboration. Teach for America Milwaukee, a upper level coaching nonprofit called Schools That Can Milwaukee, and City Year, which kind of works on a classroom level to provide support for teachers and support for students as well.
Now, had that kind of thing ever been tried before?
They'd all been working in MPS schools, sometimes together, but that is what really sets this collaboration apart. It's that shared vision. They kind of, after that first year, realized that some of the things that they were doing weren't working as well as they could have been. And it was at that point that they decided we really need to take this from us all being in this school to us all working together in order to achieve what we're looking to achieve. And, you know, there really is a lot at stake.
And as they sat down to chart that course, what were the agreed upon goals?
Essentially, they're measuring improvement there through the MAP scores. These are tests that are taken in the fall, in the winter, and in the spring of each school year. And they say this is a pretty objective measure of whether this school is improving. Now, that, you know, that just applies to academics, and there's not necessarily any direct observation being done of the student body. They are looking at how this collaboration is working together, but they're really focusing on that academic piece.
We're talking to Jabril Farage right now about his piece looking at the effort to transform the Carver Academy, one of Milwaukee's struggling public schools, and that transformation in the works right now. Now, as I understand it, there was a big culture shift that happened after this collaboration. It takes time to change things as large as a school culture, but what was the staff there trying to do as it changed the way the school felt and functioned?
Well, you know, even in the first year of the collaboration, and Again, Carver's history really comes into this because there had been a a lot of student turnover, and when you're talking about the environment there, it was loud. There were fights. It wasn't a place that, you know, the staff said was conducive to learning. So essentially, they were looking at a few markers in terms of changing what was going on there. Really, one of their big goals is improving attendance because they say, you know, we can't do anything if we don't have our students there. Like I said, one of their big challenges had been suspensions. About 50% of the student population in any given year had been suspended at least once. That's much higher than the MPS average, and something that they've said is something that they really need to look at alternatives to. So instead of suspending a child right off the bat, now obviously if something unhealthy is going on, if the environment is unsafe, they said there's nothing we can do about that. We have to suspend kids. But again, they want those kids to be there. So they really said that they are trying to pursue alternatives to that. They've also instituted what they've called contained classrooms, so all of the students receive their instruction in one classroom throughout the entire day, and their hallway movement is something that they also noted. So the students are walking on lines that are taped on the floor, essentially, and the expectation is that they're quiet while they are in that environment.
Now, what grades is the Carver Academy responsible for?
It's a K through 8 school.
K through 8. And so one striking thing that happened, sounds like after that first year of this collaboration, is that a lot of the teachers left. A huge number of staff left, and those positions were filled by new teachers. How is the school processing that change?
Well, it seems like they're really looking for some younger staff. You know, I wasn't able to actually figure out, you know, all of what went on in that exodus, but they brought in a number of first year teachers after that happened. Half of those were teachers from Teach for America, you know, very invested, if somewhat inexperienced. I talked with one of the teachers who was a second-year Teach for America teacher and had had some trouble in her classroom in terms of disruption and things along those lines. And their culture person, who is one of the administrative staff, this is also, you know, one of her first positions in that way, but they do seem invested in what's going on there, and they really talked about developing relationships. That was kind of what you know, this teacher who had trouble in the classroom talked about. Once I showed the students that I was invested in them, all that stuff kind of really started to come along.
So you've got this culture shift happening. So then I guess the big question is it working? Are suspensions going down? Are there more kids staying in school and not missing? And is the needle moving on the achievement cap? What do we know so far?
Well, I think that's really harder to say. A lot of the data just isn't there yet. You know, DPI, the Department for Public Instruction in Wisconsin, publishes all that data, but we typically don't get to see that till a little bit down the line. Actually, the suspension data hasn't yet come out for the last 2 years. So, you know, I really got into this story because I wanted to take that deeper look. And I think at this point, it's still hard for us to say, you know, where this collaboration is going. We really have yet to see that hard data. Now, on the MAP scores, which, again, like I said, they are using as a primary measure of whether this is working, there has been some significant improvement over the 2014-2015 year. Again, we didn't get to see those scores for the spring of 2015, but there were some gains at the beginning of the year. The unfortunate thing about that is that it really only brought us back to the levels of about the beginning of 2011 there. And some of the problem has been really inconsistency in terms of not maintaining the gains throughout the school year. You know, during the summers, these kids are going back to environments that are potentially, you know, very challenging. 95% of the student body is economically disadvantaged. And that was a lot of what played into what they were talking about at this school. And you know, it's a really difficult transition to make.
Jabril, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about it.
Thank you.
Jabril Farage joined us there to talk about an effort underway to transform the Carver Academy, one of Milwaukee's public schools. He wrote about that school for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service.
I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. When the summertime heat hits, it can be hard to get motivated about cooking, and that's where our next guest comes in.
This Food Friday, we decided to focus in on a dish that requires little or no heat, the salad. Our guest says salads aren't just Caesar or house. There are a lot of ways to shake up our idea of a traditional salad. She's here to help.
And we want to hear from you on this one. What is your favorite kind of salad to make in the summer? What's your favorite entree salad? How do you make it more filling? Call in and share your advice and your recipes at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Mindy Fox joins us now. She's a food writer, editor, cookbook author, and cooking instructor. She's the author of the book Salads Beyond the Bowl. Mindy, welcome to Central Time and welcome back to Wisconsin.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so thrilled to be here with you guys.
Now, when I'm making salad at home, I tend toward the boring and uncreative, I got to say. Some lettuce leaves, maybe other couple, you know, tomatoes, carrots, cucumbers mixed in there. You say salad can be a lot more than that. What do you include in your definition of salad?
Well, salad, I find, is one of the dishes that is a hard one to define, and that's a good thing. Because it really can be anything from just a few vegetables or fruits to a mixture of those things with grains, legumes or beans, nuts or seeds, eggs, pasta or potatoes, meats of all kinds, fresh herbs, cheeses of all sorts, and all kinds of other little things. Even popcorn shows up in some of my salads.
Now, in your book, you create something that you call elemental salads. What are those?
Well, that came about for me before I actually wrote this book. I noticed, and it was kind of one of the impetuses for the book, although the main motivation was because I'm just such a salad fanatic and I really can't get enough salads. But elemental salads for me are really simplifies the salad making process, which can be great for people who just feel overwhelmed by not knowing what to combine or having to make some complicated dressing. And an elemental salad for me is just a salad which has maybe four ingredients, really two or three generally, and a really simple dressing of just olive oil and some good flaky sea salt or olive oil and a little few drops of vinegar or citrus. And I'll give you some examples. The one that people ooh and ah over almost the most when I talk about it is the salad with the shortest ingredient list in my book, which is blueberries, feta cheese, and mint. And basically, I'll give you the recipe right over the phone, right over the line here.
Great.
Get some great blueberries. Sprinkle in some crumbled feta cheese and some fresh mint leaves. Drizzle some olive oil over the top. Crumble some great flaky sea salt. And some fresh cracked pepper, and you have a delicious salad, which actually can be used before a meal, just like you might do with a traditional green salad, after a meal, which in parts of Europe they do with their traditional green salads, or as an accompaniment to things like lamb chops is great, or another meat, or hamburgers. It's a great side for hamburgers. So, you know, salads, another point that I love to make about salads is that they don't just have to be the before or after the meal. They can very much be part of your meal, or two or three small salads can make up a meal in itself.
And Mindy, you put together two words that I don't often hear next to each other, salad and fanatic. How do you become a salad fanatic? What happened to make you a big fan of salads?
You know, I'm a big fan of, well, you guys welcomed me back to Wisconsin, and I don't know if listeners would know this, but I'm not a Wisconsin native, but I do go to school in your wonderful city of Madison. And while I was there, I actually worked at the farmer's market at the Capitol.
Ah.
And that might have been where I really fell in love with vegetables, because I, you know, had a real connection to the farmers at the market. And they have the most gorgeous vegetables there, as you both probably know. And I think my love of salads really stems originally from my love of vegetables. And as we talked about earlier, you know, it's goes beyond vegetables to grains and legumes. And I really love very fresh tasting food and vibrant tasting dishes. And I think the salad is a place where you really find, you get those really vibrant flavors of food and very, very fresh, clean food flavors. And so that's probably how I became a fanatic of salad.
Well, I think the farmer's market is a great place to do that. You're right. The vegetables there are, you know, are astounding, the array. And this is a great season to be getting excited about salads. Now, you've got summer season now, all this bounty from our garden. So what do you suggest putting together that makes the most of the season that we're in right now?
Well, one thing I suggest that people may not naturally gravitate towards is, for me, fresh herbs are a huge part of my salads. And I almost like to use them as additional salad greens. I will use, you know, whole or torn fresh basil or chopped chives. I like to snip the chives so they're not tiny, so you really get a nice biteful, like maybe snip them a half inch or 1 inch long. Every sorts of herb, you know, possible, I love to throw in. You can, if you have a garden or you just like to buy herbs for other dishes, it's a great way to use them up by tossing them in with your greens into, you know, any sort of salad that you might be making. So that's one of my tips that is sometimes one of the more unconventional things that people don't realize they can do. And even celery leaves, from the inner heart of the celery bunch, make wonderful kind of herbs, which can be chopped up or used whole in salads.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Mindy Fox about salads. She has a lot of creative, inventive ideas. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions on how to make a great salad or your own favorite recipes. We'll go to Tracy on the line in Green Bay now. Tracy, hi.
Hello. I've got a salad that I just kind of came up with on the fly. I don't think it's necessarily an original idea, but it was original to me. I didn't learn it from anywhere else, and I've gotten rave reviews on it every time I've served it. And it's just whatever greens you have on hand, whatever fresh vegetables you like, so that you can add what you want and leave out what you don't. And then I use as a filler any kind of lentil or mixture of lentils, so black beans, garbanzo beans, peas. And then instead of traditional dressing, I use very, very ripe avocado and dice it up and then mix it in with all of the salad fixings. And then it just kind of forms this nice glaze over everything and the flavor of avocado, plus, you know, some salt and pepper, and then fresh garlic, either pasted and mixed in with avocado before you add it, or just diced very finely and add it in.
Tracy, thank you so much. That sounds great. And Mindy, a couple ideas. You mentioned legumes there earlier. She's talking lentils or beans, maybe, or peas. But getting very creative with the dressing idea. Not really a dressing, but just avocado, salt, pepper, and a little garlic. It can be that simple.
I love what she said about that, because one thing that I find is that people shy away from making salads because they think they may have to make a complicated dressing. But really, something like your caller was just saying about using avocado, and there you have you get a creaminess from it, which she was talking about, how it coats the leaves and creates something nice and creamy and flavorful. And avocado has a richness to it, too. So salads can be filling, too. And I loved what the caller said about using pantry ingredients, too, because that's another point. I turn to the pantry quite a bit using canned tuna or canned sardines. You can get some really great, those omega-3 fatty acids, super healthy. Canned beans are wonderful for salads. And those are kind of things that I make a lot in the evening for, you know, a dinner salad that really feels satisfying and hearty. And using those kinds of ingredients with greens and with vegetables. And another thing that our caller brought up, which I thought was a terrific point, was use the vegetables that you like. And I think that's a great way to become a salad fanatic. Right. If you love, you know, fresh peas or carrots or zucchini or whatever it is that you love, tomatoes are coming in, and many people love tomatoes, wait for them all year long. Make that the sort of the star of your salad, and don't feel like you have to use a million ingredients.
Well, there's a recipe that you gave us. It sounds like one of these beautiful, satisfying entree salads. It's for green oak lettuce, fried green tomatoes, goat cheese, and then you top it off with chimichurri vinaigrette. It sounds amazing. A little more involved with the frying of the tomatoes and stuff, but how satisfying. Can you tell us a little bit about how to bring that one together?
Sure. Well, that one, really, we use green oak lettuce for this one, which is a specialty lettuce, which you might find at a farmer's market, or if you're a gardener, you might find you're growing that. But really, any green leafy lettuce can be used for this. And that's another point I just want to make as a side note. You know, most greens can be swapped for one another. If you can't find a specific ingredient, you can always, you know, just use what you can find. And this one, for people who love fried green tomatoes, which is also another ingredient that's coming up, is a wonderful recipe. It's a simple batter with cornmeal, and you get a nice crunch on the tomatoes. And then you stack them up with some crumbled goat cheese and put the lettuce greens and make a really nice vinaigrette. Chimichurri is a sauce that I decided to turn into a vinaigrette. And it's not a hard one to do that with because it has vinegar and olive oil already. And it's a cold sauce. It's an herb sauce, kind of a little bit spicy and garlicky. Your last caller might love this too because she mentioned garlic. Mm. It's a vinegar-laced Argentine sauce. And it's commonly spooned over steak, but here it's used over the green tomatoes and the lettuces with the goat cheese. And for those people who do love a little meat, it's a great salad with a simple grilled steak. Makes a terrific meal.
We're talking to cooking instructor and author Mindy Fox now about salads on this week's edition of Food Friday.
And we're taking your calls on this. Do you have questions about how to make better salads? You want to mix up your salad making this summer? If you have a favorite summer salad, let us know what it is. What do you bring when you have to bring a dish to a cookout or a party and you're the one who has to bring the salad? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And don't forget, we have two salad recipes from Mindy Fox posted there now.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now about salads with Mindy Fox. She's the author of Salads Beyond the Bowl.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite kind of salad to make or to eat? Your favorite dressing, homemade or store-bought? What's your favorite ingredient? You got to get it into that salad. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. While you're there, check out two salad recipes from Mindy Fox. Now, Mindy, last week on Food Friday, we talked about making fridge pickles. I got excited. I did it over the weekend. Now, how about using pickled ingredients in our salads? Any recommendations for, say, pickled green beans, pickled, the old-fashioned pickled cucumber?
Yes, that's a big thing with me. I love using pickled ingredients in salads. And, in fact, one of the two salads that you guys have on your website from the book has barely pickled red onions, and those are really quick pickles that just take about 10 minutes to make. You toss some thinly sliced red onion with vinegar and a little salt, let them stand for 10 minutes, kind of tossing them once or twice, then drain them, and you have a quick pickled red onion. And you can use that for all sorts of salads, not just the tomato salad that we have on your website, but can be used anytime, and those are really quick to make, and they really bring a nice acidic element to a salad.
How would you balance out an acidic element like that? What would that go well with?
So what you want to do to balance that out is just have things that are not acidic. You know, most salads have an acidic element, whether it's from in your dressing with, you know, a citrus like lemon or lime or orange or some vinegar. So maybe use a little less vinegar. If you have a pickled element, you have a acid-based element like that, you would probably hold off on using much more vinegar on your salad than that, and just use some good olive oil, which will balance out the acid flavors, and have some great vegetables. You could have some nuts, which lend sort of a more, you know, they have fat in them, so they'll absorb some of that vinegar or play off it nicely. And there's just really going back to, again, the other flavors, the other things that you like to eat.
Well, let's go to our callers now. We've got Jill on the line with us in Rice Lake. Hi, Jill.
Hi. I'd like to share a farro-based salad.
And first of all, Jill, can you tell us what farro is?
Oh, farro is a grain. I'm not sure. It kind of, everybody thinks it's wheat germ or barley. I don't know. People look at it and go, oh, it's this. But it's actually farro, F-A-R-R-O, and it's a grain. And you cook it according to the package instructions and let it cool. And then I just add whatever vegetables I've got fresh. And so right now I'm looking at one I made the other day. And it has cucumbers, zucchini, cauliflower, red onion, orange peppers. Gotta have cucumber. Okay, stir that all in. And then just olive oil and balsamic vinegar and coarse salt and pepper and fresh ground pepper. And it's just really, really good. Really good and healthy.
Okay, thanks, Jill. That's a great idea. And getting some of those whole grains in there, something that will fill you up if that's one of your complaints about salads. So that's a way to make it filling. What do you think about all the other stuff that she put together there, Mindy?
Oh, my gosh. I love her. I think these callers are great. Jill talked about one of my favorite ingredients, and I love farro, and I love whole grains. And it's actually a very easy one to cook. It only takes about, I boil it like pasta in a salty water. And it takes about 18 to 20 minutes. I like to do it so that the farro has some bite to it. So it's tender but a little toothsome still. And that's great for texture. I love what Jill said about cucumber. She got really passionate about it. Obviously, that's one of her favorite vegetables. And that's what I mean by building salads around things that you love, that you're passionate about. And then she mentioned coarse sea salt. And that's another one of my tricks. I love a good flaky or coarse sea salt. Something that kind of dissolves on your tongue, but also has some crunch to it. That just brings so much character to a salad, and it really helps draw out the flavors and make them bright of all the other vegetables and of the dressing. And she also talked about not making such a big deal about the dressing. A little olive oil, a little one of her favorite vinegars, balsamic, she mentioned, but you could really do any kind of vinegar in that salad. And I just thought it was a great combination of ingredients.
Jill, thanks.
And really flexible.
Thanks for that call as we talk about salads with Mindy Fox on this week's edition of Food Friday. Back to our callers now with Charlie in Ashland. Charlie, hi.
Hi. I have a question about durable vegetables that can withstand canoeing and backpacking trips and be out in the summer heat for a few days.
Oh, and still turn them into a salad. Great question, Charlie. Any advice, Mindy?
That is a great question. I mean, things like carrots are going to be a good bet. And you could even... carrots or cauliflower, broccoli, you could blanch them just a little bit before you pack them up for your trip so that they're not as, some of those vegetables can be a little hard to eat. I don't love to eat raw cauliflower and raw broccoli, but I do love to blanch them a little bit, which is just cooking them for a little bit, a few minutes in some boiling salted water. I like to salt the water pretty aggressively because it brings a lot of flavor to the vegetables, and then drain them. Some people then shock them in an ice water, so it stops the cooking, keeps them crunchy. That kind of thing would be great for a backpacking trip. Again, I would pack some canned sardines along too, and things like nuts. And what you would want to stay away from are things that smush easily, like tomatoes or herbs, fresh herbs that can sort of, that need refrigeration, sort of need to be handled more tender, in a more tender manner.
Mindy, very inspiring. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you guys so much. I had the best time, and I loved hearing from the callers, and everyone go out and eat salad.
That was Mindy Fox, food writer, editor, cookbook author, and cooking instructor. She's the author of the book Salads Beyond the Bowl. You can see a couple of her recipes on the Central Time Facebook page. I am inspired again. I want to get home.
Are we going to see this coming out of Rob's Test Kitchen?
Yeah, I think I'm going to. I like that idea of blanching a couple of those vegetables, the cruciferous vegetables that are a little tough, raw.
Yeah,
I don't always like them
too.
Raw in salads. Yeah, I think that's, I may experiment with that coming up.
Right, and I love the grains in the salad. That's
Me
something
too.
I don't do enough. I think I'm going to try
Ditto,
that this
yeah.
summer. Yum. All right, good inspiration there.
Central Time listeners, we're looking for some information from you. The question, have you seen a lot of spiders lately? Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Pretty random.
I was going to say, I know it sounds random, but our producer, Amanda Magnus, brought this up earlier today at our staff meeting. She said, what's up with spiders? She says she's been seeing more of them. And they're
bigger,
more intimidating, and they're advancing on her on the street from far away, and she can see them.
Pointing them out to strangers.
Apparently. And she's positing that this is a boom year part of the season
peak
for
spider.
Summers. Are we at peak spider?
Is it the time? We've dubbed it the time of the spider, except no one else in the room has noticed this. So that's why we're going to you. We want to know if you have observed what our producer Amanda has. Are you seeing more spiders? Are they bigger than usual? Can you send us pictures of these alleged spiders? Share them on the Central Time Facebook page or post at Central Time WPR.
And are you scared of spiders, or are they just a point of interest in the natural world?
Part of the chain of being.
The circle of life.
Yeah.
I like them, although not
in the
that
right
much.
Place. What used to freak me out,
distance.
I used to walk past a laundromat that left its lights on all night, you know, and, you know, big windows, and it was just spider central, huge spiders with massive
right.
webs. If you're arachnophobic, I'm sorry, I'm probably
but
freaking
Rob,
out.
But Rob, the webs are beautiful.
They are. They're really well done. I give them a thumbs up. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.